development prospects for middle-income countries. Accordingly, I am reiterating my call for the international financial institutions to address this persistent problem known as the middle-income trap. We believe that a special, highly indebted middle-income initiative could provide the framework for the type of support that these countries require. It is our great hope that the UN high-level middle-income countries meeting scheduled for later this year will give the fullest consideration to these matters and ways in which the UN system can provide support. In the interim, Jamaica continues to work with partners like Canada to provide a platform whereby countries can engage directly with actors in the private sector, development finance institutions, and regulators. Our goal is to forge collaborative partnerships with UN member states and the private sector to determine practical, solution-oriented ways of securing new and long-term capital investment, utilizing a mix of public, private, and blended financing to implement the SDGs. Even as we diligently seek financing for sustainable development, we are mindful that we live in a world where international peace and security are under continuous threat. The world has witnessed several terrorist attacks and grapples with a range of conflicts that appear intractable. The Secretary General has therefore appropriately placed emphasis on conflict prevention, as well as on promoting a new disarmament agenda. As he has often stated, we must confront issues concerning peace and security along a peace continuum, from prevention, conflict resolution and peacekeeping, to peacebuilding and sustainable long-term development. Jamaica is especially interested in the efforts to build a secure environment through combating the illicit traffic and trade in small arms and light weapons. We have made significant national institutional changes, undertaken policy enhancements, and adopted legislative amendments in the areas of security and justice in our own country. We now look forward to working with other member states, the UN system, and partners at all levels to ensure that the progress we have made is sustainable. Madam President, societies function best when an inclusive global environment is created, where no one feels left behind. Implementation of the SDGs must be people-centered. Embargoes and other financial and economic barriers must not become tools to prevent people, such as our neighbors, the citizens of the Republic of Cuba, from attaining their rightful development goals. Jamaica continues to call for a lifting of the embargoes against that country. We also believe it is important to support the efforts of the Secretary General and his special envoys in pursuing political processes related to situations in the Western Sahara, Syria, and Myanmar. As we prepare to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, let us continue to be mindful of the many amongst us who consistently face discrimination of various forms. Jamaica has been at the forefront of international human rights, having been the first country to incorporate human rights into our foreign policy strategy, a principle that we guard fiercely. We will never lose sight of the responsibility to promote and protect the interests of the vulnerable. We are especially keen to ensure that our women, children, persons living with disabilities, elderly, and young people can make meaningful contributions and reap the benefits of a safe and prosperous society. Madam President, Jamaica will shortly assume membership of the ECOSOC, currently chaired by St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Our term of office will coincide with what promises to be a momentous year for that UN body. We are committed to advancing the work of the Council, including during its high-level political forum. Madam President, societies are not sustainable without healthy citizens. As a region that is severely impacted by non-communicable diseases, we in the Caribbean are actively promoting and implementing measures to reverse this trend by encouraging health and wellness. I was truly energized as I joined my CARICOM colleagues this morning in launching Caribbean Moves, a region-wide initiative aimed at raising awareness and increasing physical activity among our young people and those not so young. We look forward to building on the outcomes of the high-level meeting that was convened this week on NCDs. Jamaica will also support ongoing actions to combat tuberculosis as well as to promote universal health coverage. Madam President, you have challenged us to ensure that the UN remains a beacon of hope for each citizen across the globe. To that end, the UN must be responsive to an ever-changing and unpredictable world if it is to remain relevant and effective. The Secretary General is correct in stating that one of the most valuable assets of the United Nations is its capacity to operate as a convener of people, a proponent of ideas, a catalyst for action, and a driver of solutions. For this reason, we remain steadfast in our support of efforts to reform the UN. We commend the Secretary General's action in pressing for reform of the peace and security architecture, the UN development system, and its management and operational structure. Of course, we are ever mindful of the words of our recently departed Secretary General Kofi Annan, a stalwart of multilateral diplomacy, that no reform of the UN will be complete without reform of the Security Council. Madam President, our global alliance comprises 193 sovereign states. But there is no denying the fact that we are all interdependent. A joint and multifaceted response is required to surmount the myriad hurdles ahead of us, for it is only through collaboration that we can build our societies and secure our common future. Our legacy must be one that uplifts and inspires. Let this, therefore, be our mandate for this 73rd session of our General Assembly. Ladies and gentlemen, friends, I thank you.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I wish to thank the Prime Minister of Jamaica, Minister of Defense, Economic Growth and Job Creation for the statement just made, and I request protocol to escort His Excellency. The Assembly will hear a statement by Her Excellency Jacinda Ardern, Prime Minister of New Zealand. May I request protocol to escort Her Excellency? I have great pleasure in welcoming the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Her Excellency Jacinda Ardern, and I invite her to address the General Assembly.
In a mananui o na whenua o te ao, tēnā koutou katoa. Nei rā te reo mihi, mai aha o Aotearoa, tēnā tātou e na kaupapa kōrero. Ka arahina e tātou. Me te nā kōpono, me te kotahitanga o te tangata. Madam President, Mr. Secretary General, friends in the global community, my opening remarks were in Te Reo Māori, the language of the Indigenous people of Aotearoa New Zealand. As is tradition, I acknowledge those who are here, why we are here, and the importance of our work. It seems a fitting place to start. I'm struck as a leader attending my first United Nations General Assembly by the power and the potential that resides here. But in New Zealand, we have always been acutely aware of that. We are a remote nation at the bottom of the South Pacific. Our nearest neighbours take 3 hours to reach by plane, and anywhere that takes less than 12 hours is considered close. I have no doubt, though, that our geographic isolation has contributed to our values. We are a self-deprecating people. We're not ones for status. We'll celebrate the local person who volunteers at their sports club as much as we will celebrate the successful entrepreneur. Our empathy and strong sense of justice is matched only by our pragmatism. We are, after all, a country made up of two main islands, one simply named North and the other South. For all of that, our isolation has not made us insular. In fact, our engagement with the world has helped shape who we are. I am a child of the 80s, a period in New Zealand's history where we didn't just observe international events, we challenged them. Whether it was apartheid in South Africa or nuclear testing in the Pacific, I grew up learning about my country and who we were by the way that we reacted to international events. Whether it was taking to the streets or changing our laws, we have seen ourselves as members of a community and one that we have a duty to use our voice within. I am an incredibly proud New Zealander. But much of that pride has come from being a strong and active member of our international community, not in spite of it. In the heart of that international community has been this place. Emerging from a catastrophic war, we have collectively established through convention, charters, and rules a set of international norms and human rights. All of these are an acknowledgement that we are not isolated. Governments do have obligations to their people and each other, and that our actions have a global effect. In 1945, New Zealand Prime Minister Peter Fraser said that the UN Charter offered perhaps a last opportunity to work in unison, to realise the hope in the hearts of all of us, for a peace that would be real, lasting, and worthy of human dignity. But none of these founding principles should be consigned to the history books. In fact, given the challenges we face today and how truly global they are in their nature and impact, the need for collective action and multilateralism has never been clearer. And yet for all of that, the debate and dialogue we hear globally is not centred on the relevance and importance of our international institutions. Instead, we find ourselves having to defend their very existence. That surely leaves us all with the question, how did we get here? And how do we get out? Now, if anything unites us politically in this place right now, it is this. Globalization has had a massive impact on our nations and the people we serve. Now, while that impact has been positive for many, for others, It has not. The transition our economies have made has often been jarring and the consequences harsh. And so amongst unprecedented global economic growth, we have still seen a growing sense of isolation, dislocation, and a sense of insecurity and the erosion of hope. Now, as politicians and governments, we all have choices in how we respond to these challenges. We can use the environment to blame nameless, faceless other, to feed the sense of insecurity, to retreat into greater levels of isolationism, or we can acknowledge the problems we have and we can seek to fix them. In New Zealand, going it alone is not an option. Aside from our history as a trading nation, and proudly so, but we, even without those founding principles, there are not just questions of nationhood to consider, there are generational demands upon us too. It should hardly come as a surprise that we have seen a global trend of young people showing dissatisfaction with our political systems and calling on us to do things differently. Why wouldn't they? Were they themselves have had to adapt so rapidly to a changing world? Within a few short decades, we now have a generation who will grow up more connected than ever before. Digital transformation will determine whether the jobs they are training for will even exist in two decades. In education or the job market, they won't just compete with their neighbour, but their neighbouring country. This generation is a borderless one, at least in a virtual sense, one that increasingly sees themselves as global citizens. And as their reality changes, they expect that ours will too. That we'll see and understand our collective impact, and that we will change the way that we use our power. And if we're looking for an example of where the next generation is calling on us to make that change, we need look no further than climate change. 2 weeks ago, Pacific Island leaders gathered together at the Pacific Islands Forum. It was at this meeting on the small island nation of Nauru that climate change was declared to be the single biggest threat to security in the Pacific. Please just think about that for a moment. Of all of the challenges we debate and discuss, rising sea levels present the single biggest threat to our region. For those who live in the South Pacific, the impacts of climate change are not academic or even arguable. They are watching the sea levels rise, the extreme weather events increase, and the impact on their water supply and food crops. Now, we can talk all we like about the science and what it means, what temperature rises we need to limit in order to survive, but there is a grinding reality. And hearing someone from a Pacific island talk about where the sea was when they were a child and the potential loss of their entire village as an adult. Our action in the wake of this global challenge remains optional, but the impact of inaction does not. Nations like Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, or Kiribati, small countries who have contributed the least to global climate change, are and will suffer the full force of a warming planet. If my Pacific neighbours do not have the option of opting out of the effects of climate change, why should we be able to opt out of taking action to stop it? Any disintegration of multilateralism, any undermining of climate-related targets and agreements aren't interesting footnotes in geopolitical history. They are catastrophic. In New Zealand, we are determined to play our part. We will not issue any further offshore oil and gas exploration permits. We have set a goal of 100% renewable energy generation by 2035. established a green infrastructure fund to encourage innovation, and rolled out an initiative to plant 1 billion trees over the next 10 years. These plans are unashamedly ambitious. The threat climate change poses demands it. But we only represent less than 0.2% of global emissions. That's why, as a global community, not since the inception of the United Nations has there been a greater example of the importance of collective action and multilateralism than climate change. It should be a rallying cry to all of us. And yet there is a hesitance that we can ill afford, a calculation of personal cost, of self-interest. But this is not the only challenge where domestic self-interest is the first response, and where an international or collective approach has been diluted at best or rejected at worst. But it would be both unfair and naive to argue that retreating to our own borders and interests has meant turning our backs on a perfect system. The international institutions we have committed ourselves to have not been perfect, but they can be fixed. And that is why the challenge I wish to issue today is this. Together, we must rebuild and recommit to multilateralism. We must redouble our efforts to work as a global community. We must rediscover our shared belief in the value rather than the harm of connectedness. We must demonstrate that collective international action not only works, but it is in the best interests of all of us. We must show the next generation that we are listening and that we have heard them. But if we're truly going to take on a reform agenda, we need to acknowledge the failings that have led us to this crossroad. International trade, for instance, has helped bring millions of people out of poverty around the world. But some have felt their standard of living slide. In New Zealand, we ourselves have seen the hesitancy around trade agreements amongst our own population. The correct response is not to repeat the mistakes of the past and be seduced by the false promises of protectionism. Rather, we must all work to ensure that the benefits of trade are distributed fairly across our societies. We can't rely on international institutions to do this, in the same way as we cannot blame them if they haven't delivered these benefits. It is incumbent on us to build productive, sustainable, inclusive economies and demonstrate to our peoples that when done right, international economic integration can make all of us better off. And if we want to ensure anyone is better off, surely we should start with the most vulnerable. In New Zealand, we have set ourselves an ambitious goal. We want to be the best place in the world to be a child. It's hardly the stuff of hard and fast measures. After all, how do you measure play, a feeling of security and happiness? But we can measure material deprivation, and we can measure poverty, and so we will. And not only that, we are making it law that we report on those numbers every single year alongside our budgets. What better way to hold ourselves to account, and what better group to do that for than children? But if we are focused on nurturing that next generation, we equally have to worry about what it is that we are handing down to them, including our environment. In the Māori language, there is a word that captures the importance of that role, kaitiakitanga. It means guardianship. The idea that...